Welcome, friends. You are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is your host, Henrik Palmgren. We are recording from the west coast of Sweden, but you can reach us from around the globe wherever internet is available simply by going to our website, redicecreations.com. There you can find all of our previous radio shows and also our news updated on a daily basis. Before we get today's program started, just let me say thanks to Donald Scott for being with us last week and talking about the Electric Universe thesis. Very interesting stuff. Tune in if you missed it. Either you can download the show or any of our previous shows for free. We have a growing archive right there for you. We also have a streaming Flash MP3 player available on the site if you prefer that instead. So if you like what we do here also, tell your friends, help us spread the word about the radio show and the site. Let's get today's show going. All right, welcome my friends. Today we have Michael Tessarion back with us for his monthly visit. Michael is on with us the third Thursday each month. And last time we talked about the outsider and the guilt complex, and we are going to pick up from there today. If you missed any of our previous shows with Michael, just head on over to our radio archive or click on our regulars button from the radio section, and from there you'll be able to find all of our previous shows with Michael. His website, of course, is michaeltessarion.com, where you can find all the appropriate links to Michael's different sites and also, of course, his blog. So I'm looking forward to diving into today's topic. So let's say welcome back, Michael, to the show, and thanks for being here again, my friend.
Oh, not at all. It's always a pleasure, Henrik.
Awesome, awesome. You know, one very interesting thing that you comment about here is very recently Bono got his knighthood, and this is also you know, a very interesting thing. Would you like to comment a bit on that?
I think I really don't want to, because it's so appalling that I'd rather forget about the whole subject. But it's just incredible. It's just, I mean, everyone that you know has always, how many people do you know that will sit and tell you, hey, I met my hero and it didn't turn out anything like what I thought. You know, so the world has that experience in which your heroes often, don't turn out to be the same kind of person that you imagine.
Yeah.
Not that Bono's any hero, ever been a hero of mine, but, and then what happens is we turn on, some people in the media even. You can be seduced into, getting behind these people when you ostensibly see them opening charities, and...
Yeah, yeah.
Wearing their, little, hammer and sickle pin, or whatever, their Bob Marley t-shirts, or getting up and talking in front of the United Nations, and it just looks so wonderful on TV.
Yeah.
And then we start thinking these guys are just the best, and we don't look any deeper. I mean, I always look at the symbolism, so I can usually tell by the symbolism that any of these people use.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that Bono's latest charity, uses a red square?
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about that, yeah.
Isn't that incredible? And then, 5 minutes later, he's on his knees in front of the Queen,
yeah.
I'm not him, and I guess he can break open a bunch of champagne with his mates.
I mean, this guy was he was nominated for the position of the World Bank. This guy.
I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Obviously Paul Wolfowitz got the position, but Bono was actually one of the nominators. I mean, this guy obviously has some ties higher up, I mean.
Well, to cut a long story short, that's exactly the point of people like myself, is that you have to watch these people's champions because they're not what they appear. But even if you don't believe, in any sort of, hidden agenda or whatever, for the very fact that an Irishman gets on his knees to that creature over in Buckingham Palace, is already, in my mind, and I'm not even a real big Republican supporter or anything like that,
yeah.
But the very fact that the man claims to be an Irishman, and same with Bob Geldof, to get on your knees to these people who have massacred and desecrated your country for I don't know how long, how many centuries, is to me the height of just, there's not even words, so I'd rather not even go into it because it will really get me as mad as hell, as they say, But, of course then, being more objective, the fact is that this is a dead giveaway.
Yeah.
That these people are one, how can we say that there's a one-party system operating in the world? How can we say that a lot of these people's champions are major, lieutenants of the Illuminati. How can we say that some of these actors and celebrities, or, you know, are children of the Dionysian cult? You know, you know, the world just looks at us and thinks it's nonsense. And yet here you have it. Here you have blatant examples, just like this. You have assassinations. You know, like the lead singer from the NXS, Michael Hutchins, I believe his name was, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a Bob Geldof tie-in with that assassination. It's never been properly mediatized, never been properly explained how this wonderful, attractive man would be found hanging from his own door, you know, in Australia, and the police are releasing, you know, information that he was a drug fiend, and of course his closest allies, his closest friends, his parents, all his ex-girlfriends are saying, absolutely no way, this man would never have committed suicide. He was completely full of life. He had 101 projects he was doing. You know, he was totally a man that would never do that. And yet you find out that his girlfriend or wife was Bob Geldof's ex-wife. Okay, so we got questions here, you know.
Yeah.
I've had questions since 1982. And, you know, I'm hoping that the world forgets, you know. The world forgets that these Bonos and Bob Geldofs and Sting and a lot of these other people have major ties to aristocracy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in England and also in the rest of the world.
By the way, do you know if these guys get into some kind of order when they get knighted, or how does that work?
Oh, yeah. It's a very major thing. It's not just some small, pathetic thing. You know, I refer people to a book called Dope Incorporated. That's Dope, D-O-P-E, Incorporated, by the Lyndon LaRouche people. By the great Webster Topley.
Yeah.
Webster Topley is one of the greatest, you know, investigators into secret societies, especially when it comes to the British government.
Yeah.
And he will tell you in his work, in his book, better than I ever could, about these kinds of knighthoods, what they stand for, what they're really about. If people go to the Taroscope's links page and go to the section on the Illuminati and secret societies, some of the first links there are to chivalric orders. And they still exist, showing the logos and symbolism, and what they all really mean. What they're really telling you is that, listen, buddy, it's just like when you shake a person's hand. When you shake a person's hand that you meet, you're sitting having coffee and a friend comes over, the very act of shaking hands or, you know, slapping somebody on the back, I mean, I know in Sweden that's considered awful to do that, and I agree, but, you know, to have so much bodily contact, but, you know, the whole idea is that when you shake hands, you're saying, hey, you're one of me.
Yeah.
You know, we're friends. We acknowledge each other.
Yeah.
Well, you see, in the nightly, when you get on your knees there, they're literally telling you that, you know, that you are now one of us. It doesn't matter what the mugs think outside, but you are now one of us. We're going to take care of your children. We're going to make sure they go to the good schools. You'll have everything you want. We're just letting you know it's more than a nod. It's more than a wink. You're one of us. Now, you may wear, you know, denim jeans, and you may operate in the social milieu. You know, Mr. Jagger or Mr., you know, whoever, right?
Yeah.
Elton Bloody John or whoever, you know, and, you know, that's fine. You know, the world can accept you. The world doesn't know anything, so the world will imagine that you're just the same person that they knew.
Yeah.
But we're letting you know that, you know, we you're seated at our table, basically. And from that moment on, you know, your life changes dramatically.
Yeah.
But the facts of it are also very intriguing, and people can look it up. Knighthoods, just go to Wikipedia, online sources, and look up knighthoods and find out what it is. What is a knighthood? Why would they want to do that? Why would they want to endorse you in that way?
So, do you feel like, you know, moving on here, Michael? Or?
Better do, because I'll get real mad.
Okay, yeah, sure. You know, last time we were talking about man's misunderstanding of the word enlightenment, and also, of course, darkness. And, you know, how can a man be illuminated by darkness?
Yeah, the last show, yeah, we left off with that. I mean, it's just this, you know, and even in the time since we did the show, you know, I even got emails about that question. It is difficult because enlightenment has so often been, you know, put towards us in a sort of a wrong way. It's not something to do with, you know, my big philosophy is that people need to just reevaluate the word enlightenment and not think of it so much in terms of luminescence, but in terms of weight, you know. And, you know, I keep giving descriptions about this to help people grasp this idea. For instance, I don't know if anyone has ever noticed that whenever you solve a great problem, say your car's broken down, you know, and then suddenly, you know, the service guys appear and they fix it and you're on your way, or say that you have, you know, met a person who, you know, makes you feel you're great, just a master or a teacher, or you have a wonderful time. You have a wonderful time meeting these people, or say you have had a great experience, you know, on holiday or whatever. And what is the actual emotion that you feel? It's kind of lightness, isn't it?
A heavy weight has been lifted from my shoulders.
A heavy weight has been lifted. It's exactly right. You know, I met Jimmy Page. You know, I can think right now of the time when I met Jimmy Page, or you know, the time I was at the last rock concert I went to, and I just felt great. You don't walk around with this halo. It doesn't come to you in the feeling of luminescence. It comes to you in the feeling of lightness, like a child, you know, a childlike sort of innocence.
Yeah, absolutely.
And did not Christ, you know, the figure of the Bible, at least Jesus said, you know, no one can enter the kingdom of heaven unless they become like a little child. So, again, we've got to look at this, and then we'll understand a little bit more about the question of enlightenment. Now, it's very important to do that, because the Christian world has sent us this very negative counter-message about darkness.
Yeah.
So we're all walking around about, you know, with this fear of nature and fear of darkness. Well, that can be helped a lot if you actually think about the other side of it. If you're thinking about enlightenment becomes sane and rational, you might end up realizing that there's nothing negative about darkness at all. In fact, the darkness that, you know, is being put before us as something negative is actually an incredible enlightener, because it's our inner self. It's our inner shadow self.
Yeah.
So you can be illuminated by the darkness. Not maybe as a Christian would understand it, but, I mean, all the Christian, you know, prophets talk about the dark night of the soul and going through the time of great trials and tribulations. I mean, Samson even has his eyes physically put out in the Bible, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and certainly in all the Greek myths you have this kind of understanding, the New Age movement talking about going through the dark night of the soul.
Yeah.
And alchemy, it's a, you know, I mean, all the mythologies talk about it. Buddha went through it. Odin went through it.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to understand this dynamic and stop thinking in terms of luminescence, because it's not a positive. You know, later on we're probably going to do a show on the whole Lucifer concept, the origins of Lucifer. Well, you know, let's just say right now that if you keep on thinking of spiritual wisdom in the form of luminescence and enlightenment, then you have a paradox. You not only have the paradox of how to deal with the darkness, but you have a paradox in that the fallen angel is called Lucifer, the son of light.
Yep.
So, you know, the paradoxes pile up on top of your head, metaphysically speaking. Go, wait a minute, if I'm meant to be seeking for enlightenment and I've associated wisdom and knowledge with light, how do I reconcile the fact that, you know, there's a Luciferian concept going on here? See, so we'll have further questions. We won't have the answers that we are due unless we start to reevaluate these concepts.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree. It's totally schizo, the messages that people are getting from this. You know, people may have a difficult time, you know, comprehending. Also, of course, you know, the difference between the ego and the self. Maybe you can elaborate on this idea more.
The ego and the self. Well, you see, this is you know, such a massive concept. I mean, it's so great that we have time to go into it, because we really do need, you know, one of the greatest things in this world is to basically understand this difference, and they're not the same. And, you know, to make it very blatant, there are people who all their life will be creatures of the ego. And then there are people who will discover what the difference is, the selfhood. I mean, this is basically when you're really walking the road of enlightenment, this is what is really going to be, you know, be one of the most important of all concepts. Because if a person is just a role, if a person is just, you know, a mold that society has created for them, how can that entity be enlightened? If it's nothing to begin with.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
It's impossible.
Only a self that can ever be enlightened. But you're talking about the actual differences. Well, then, the first thing we have to understand about the ego is that it's basically the being that was created in the trauma that I spoke of in the Atlantis books, with the enormous traumas that have happened from 50,000 years ago, and then moving up to 30,000, then moving up to 10,000. All the scholars have noticed that there's just been enormous cataclysms now. And this is finally coming out of the bag. Well, all of these cataclysms, you know, people point to the physical consequences. I've always spoken about the psychic consequences of the coming of evil into the world, and also the creation, literally, of what we would call an interior life. Your ability to be able to think about stuff inside your head is an abnormality, by the way. It's something that didn't exist, in the blink of an eye in history. And it is very recent. It's a recent phenomenon. We're so used to it, we accept, oh, there's the outer world, and then there's this little dialogue, you know, that we have inside our brain.
Mm-hmm.
This is a completely artificial state. I want people to really think about it. The interior life is new. It's modern. It came with the birth of the ego. And the ego is basically an idea creator. It creates ideas.
Yeah.
And it doesn't create very rational or healthy ideas. And within the ego, you have innumerable ideas of things. But the most important idea that you have is an idea of yourself.
Yeah.
And this idea of yourself is strengthened by everyone you come into contact with who sells you back some information about yourself. And it all gets stored in the memory banks so that we have this idea of who we are.
Hmm.
But this idea of who we are is not the self. Like we said on the last show, you know,
yeah,
your idea of an oak tree may not be, it is not an oak tree itself.
Yeah.
But we are conditioned into believing that it is.
Hmm.
You know, I got a couple of quotes from Carl Jung.
Hmm.
If I can read those, they'll probably make things a lot easier to understand.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
And of course, he was one of the masters on this concept. He said that there was a time when rational present-day consciousness was not yet separated from the historical psyche, the collective unconscious. So he's talking about, again, it's recent. It was a time when there was no division. There was no unconscious and then conscious mind.
Mm.
He says, inasmuch as the ego is only the center of my field of consciousness, it is not identical with the totality of my psyche, being merely a complex among other complexes. Hence, I discriminate between the ego and the self, since the ego is only the subject of my consciousness, while the self is the subject of my totality. Hence, it also includes the unconscious psyche. In this sense, the self would be an ideal factor which embraces and includes the ego. The best way to think of it is like an egg. If you crack an egg open, you see the yellow part and then you see the white part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what it is. The ego, in fact, the word ego comes from the word for egg.
Hmm.
The two words come from the same word root.
Yeah, interesting.
Is like this little yellow, you know, thing in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And the consciousness is all of the egg, the totality of the egg, the complete egg. Now, mm-hmm, we want to choose to live inside that one small area. But Jung goes on to say, it is certain that the original psyche possesses no consciousness of itself. Okay, so he's saying the primordial psyche way back.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have any consciousness of itself. This only comes in the course of development. A development falls mostly within the historical epoch.
Hmm.
Even today we know of primitive tribes whose level of consciousness is not so far removed from the darkness of the primordial psyche. Nevertheless, its development so far has made it emancipated enough to forget its dependence upon the unconscious psyche.
Hmm.
So what he's saying is that, you see, it's a very recent phenomenon, this birth of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
But it's long enough for the ego to delude itself into thinking that there's nothing else but its own reality.
Hmm.
See, does that sound familiar? I mean, this is how the whole world operates.
Yeah.
In which, you know, everyone thinks that they are the most important being on the earth.
Yeah.
You know, governments think, you know, our country is the most important. You see, it all comes from the ego thinking that there's no other wider territory in the psyche.
So
that it inhabits this tower, and this tower exists, you know, sort of floating there with no landscape. This is the kind of delusion that causes so many, many things to go wrong. And I can't overstate that this amputated ego, you know, did come about as a result of these earth traumas. So physical things caused this to happen. I mean, in the couple of the web streams I've done, I've got some brilliant quotes from some fantastic authors about this. I'd like to go through two or three of them because, you know, want to really stress this. There was a, from a book by cellist Glenn Denning, Henrik, he quotes Terry Kellogg. He says that Terry Kellogg emphasizes the fact that abusive behaviors, whether we direct them to ourselves, other people, or other species, are not natural to human beings. People enact such behavior because, he says, something unnatural has happened to them. I and they have become deranged. Yeah. Then Jack Barringer, in his book Past Shock, which was a very big influence on my work, he says that Julian James, the author of The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, claimed that this period, thousands of years ago, was a time when of intense psychosis for the emerging human race. So this is, you know, again, Julian James was one of the top psychologists and brain specialists, you know, one of the most academically superior intellects who discovered basically what I'm talking about here.
Yeah.
And he goes on, Terence McKenna, the famous Terence McKenna, said that he was talking about Julian James. He said that James has suggested that human consciousness has changed its character even in historical times. The ego as we know it was not really in existence except under extreme stress. And then it presented itself almost as an exterior, that's exterior intrusion into consciousness, like the voice of a god. So here we have the scientists backing up this, you know, theory.
Yeah.
That the ego that people wake up every day is an imposter. It's an extremely, you know, it did a good thing. It kept us alive.
Yeah.
You know, it is a remnant of the old consciousness, just like a, you know, you can see water, the ocean. There's so many places have reclaimed land where they built dams and the ocean has pulled out.
Mm.
But you still get some marshy lands and some little ponds and pools.
Yeah.
You know, I could think of the band Rush in their album Permanent Waves. They've got a song just exactly about this, that when the ocean pulls out, what's left is these tiny little microscopic pools of water with whole ecosystem.
Mm.
And in that ecosystem, you could be thinking that you're the whole ocean.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you get down close and look at it, it can be considered, you know, you see shellfish, you see life going on in that little pool.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But that little pool is not the whole ocean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a situation in which we have ourselves, you know.
You know, the yes, as you say, the ego, it's not very old. It's a very recent creation, then, historically speaking. And, I mean, is it that we, you know, have not yet learned to, you know, deal with this? I mean, so is this part of the problem, so to speak?
Yes, it's very much the, you see, this is, it's like the tower card in the tarot cards.
Mm.
Pick out number 16, and you see this very disturbed tower. You know, the ego is moving this way and that way in the wind. It's not on firm foundations. You cannot put anything on a slanty foundation, a wonky foundation, and hope that it's going to grow straight.
Yeah.
So as the ego progresses, the ego thinks, hey, fantastic, years are going by, I'm in control. But the thing is that for every new layer that the ego puts on, it's getting more and more and more, you know, tilting like the Leaning Tower of Pisa problem, because the foundation from the beginning was not straight. And the ego has never dealt with that foundation. It's just kept building and building and building.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we have a, you know, I look at Lord of the Rings. You know, Lord of the Rings, the movie, the book, that's what the Dark Lord is. Sauron, the Dark Lord, standing and living in his tower there, is exactly that. He is the ego.
Yeah.
He is basically the, you know, the form of the ego that literally wants to be so exclusive and dominate and dominate and dominate. That's partly, I think, what that story is all about. It's a tremendous rendering of this crisis. And, you know, we have a situation in which people now are, you know, imprisoned in this tower.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the self is very different. The self is a very different kind of thing. You know, one of the other problems that we have, you see, in dealing with the ego is that we waste a lot of chi. The ego is a living thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the ego realizes that in order to sustain its life, having peace and calm and quiet and a loving environment doesn't help the ego. Because if you have a very, very peaceful, you know, environment and a peaceful kind of life without a lot of mayhem, people will then slowly start gravitating back to nature, start asking the big questions. They will start to think metaphysically. They will take care of their bodies, you see, and they'll become very, very spiritualized people. So this is this natural. Human beings become like that naturally if things are provided, you know, in a good way. If you watch the movie Lost Horizons, the original black and white movie, that's exactly what they show you, that even a bunch of pretty tyrannous people, if they're brought into a beautiful, you know, surroundings, like a monastery or a lamasery, they actually, you know, completely drop all their evil ways. So the ego, realizing that, oh my God, if that happens, I might be put out of business. People will start asking, who is God? What's the bigger question?
Yeah.
So the ego has all the chaos and havoc going on in the world and in our lives perpetually. Every day there's something to troubleshoot. Constant conflict, constant, you know, upheaval, constant domestic minutia to get involved with.
I mean, is it too far then to say that, you know, this is a form, the ego is a form of, you know, psychic cancer, like a parasite that is, you know, trying to sustain itself on
and
us.
In fact, in many Star Treks and in many, you know, Twilight Zones, this is exactly how the great science fiction writers have portrayed the mind, you know, as some sort of demonic child, you know, who plays with its toys and is completely out of control, who acts, you know, like a small dwarf behind the screen. Yeah, It's a precarious, crazy, tyrannical, very, very, very brilliant thing as well.
Yeah.
But the problems, it's pathological. It has a very severe issue that it, in order to perpetuate its own existence, it uses what we would call conflict. So when you're observing conflict in your life next time, you know, even if it's just driving the car or going to get the shopping, or, you know, you hear about the conflicts of other people, or conflict here, there's conflict there, you have conflict with the neighbors, you have conflict with the builders, the contractors, oh my goodness, there's conflict at work, oh, I just had this argument with, you know, some guy who came in.
Yeah.
My goodness, all this perpetual conflict on level after level, after tier after tier after tier, is actually by design. It's there because the ego gets a booster out of that. And same with flexing a muscle when you're weight training. It's the friction of the, you know, movement, the peristalsis of the movement that creates the blood to flow to build up the muscle.
So
the ego is nothing but a psychic muscle, and it breeds on conflict. And, of course, what does that do for us? It wastes a lot of our life energy, a lot of our chi, which goes into troubleshooting a life full of conflict. Is, of course, the famous stressed life that everyone's living, and nobody knows how to take it back to the problem of the ego, this constant thing. And then, of course, when the trouble gets really bad, then the ego comes along and goes, oh, I'll help you. We got gurus. Remember, remember last time we were talking about the branches of the inauthentic life? Starting from the guilt complex itself, and one of them was, you know, renovation. You hate the life you're living, but just try to decorate it better. Well, this is where the gurus come in. Of course, the ego knows that it's just, it's got this chaotic office, that this house is just absolutely in disarray, like something out of Lewis Carroll, you know? So what does it do? It brings in the super organizers to take care of it all. Not to take you out of the tower, but to decorate the tower, to move the furniture around, to say, oh, we'll streamline this place for you. It's like this fanatical obsession that they have now with TV programs about, you know, fixing your house up. Where you go to work for, you know, 12 hours and suddenly you come back and they've painted polka dots all over your house. Well, this is what the ego, this is what the ego does. It goes, we'll lay on the gurus. We got techniques and paths, and we'll really, you know, make this luxurious. We know you don't like it, living, you know, like a serf, a coal miner in this totally horrible building. So we will, you know, we'll super organize your whole inner architecture, and that, that'll be brilliant.
Short-term solutions, that seems popular at the moment,
And the other thing we need to realize is very, very important about the ego, before we finish about the ego, is that what we call myth and what we call history is the ego taking notes. Just as you, you know, keep a journal about your day-to-day existence, well, the ego has been keeping a journal from the moment of its inception. And that journal is mythology. So when people say, oh, all the characters seem to be the same, all over the world, the mythological, you know, the hero with a thousand faces, the sun king, the sun god, even the scenarios are almost identical. Well, it's the same author. Everyone has got one thing in common all over the world, a brain, an ego. So if you think about it, and it's quite a concept to think about, but Joseph Campbell sort of expressed this a little, we have to understand that there is a diary being kept as this ego progresses down through the millennium. And it's not a diary being kept by the soul, as people like Jung thought. It's not. It's a diary being kept by the ego to commemorate and memorialize its own movement, because the essence of the ego is narcissism. So, the only thing that the ego cares about is itself. So it wanted to memorialize its own trek down through the ages. And that diary is mythology.
So could it be that we unconsciously are actually are, you know, recreating these mythologies in our modern world today?
Oh, yeah. This is the crazy director.
Yeah.
He's got the ego there with a bullhorn, like, you know, the, like the most incredible, you know, Cecil B. DeMille. And the parts of history that it liked before, which it thought was a great success, it wants to replay those, just like the endless, you know, replays of TV shows. So, you know, that's why you have constant replay, mythologically speaking. It's because the director wants to see the performance again. This is this crazy Nero, you know, saying, listen to my song. You'll play the same thing a thousand times till you're bored to death with it. And so in history, we also play out similar scenarios because, you know, this King Nothing, the ego, wants to basically, you know, live out that big high that it had before when it saw, you know, whatever particular scenario that it dreamt up.
Ah, very interesting. Yeah, that that makes a lot of sense, actually. So, very interesting. And also, of course, you know, you emphasize the connections between the mind and the world. between psychic right. energy and physical energy. And can you go into that more?
Well, yeah, but I want to finish the... we talk about the ego. What is the self? In order to distinguish the self is not an idea. The self is not an idea created by your ego about yourself. And in fact, many people have to deconstruct the ideas that they have about themselves. They can either do this through a psychologist or do it personally through personal ritual.
Mm.
Or, you know, they can listen to some Byron Katie. I don't care what it is, but in order to even sort of get to even the remotest understanding of what you are as a self, you're going to have to deconstruct the ideas of the ego about yourself.
Hmm.
And on top of that, you're going to have to deconstruct all the rubbish that people tell you about yourself.
Hmm.
None of that has any meaning.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can be more poetic about it, because in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, they have a poem about the self, and it says, "That person, the maker of all things, the great self, seated forever in the heart of man, is perceived by the heart, by the thought, by the mind. They who know that become immortal."
Hmm.
In the Katha Upanishad, it says, "That self is smaller than small, greater than great, is hidden in the heart of this creature." You see, so the ancients are also talking in the most ancient of times about the self.
Hmm.
And Jung, he says in one of his letters, "Although the self is my origin, it is also the goal of my quest."
Hmm.
And this brings up a very important point, because the self... or if we want to talk in religious terms, the self is the soul. But the interesting thing is that the soul is something that you create during your life through what is called experience.
Hmm.
It's not really something that's given to you. So this is just another little, you know, important aside
yeah.
what we've been talking about, is that, yeah, there is a thing called a self. But believe me, the self is something that people have to work on. It is the soul, and it's something that you have to work on with experience. It's not going to be given to you by some pope or priest.
Hmm.
It's certainly not already given to you by God. You're here to create a thing called a self.
Hmm.
Now, Nietzsche, of course, he said that the individual, and he's talking about the self, self person,
yeah.
the individual has always had to struggle to keep from being overwhelmed by the tribe. If you try it, you will often be lonely and sometimes frightened. But no price is too high to pay for the privilege of owning yourself.
Hmm.
So he is therefore also there talking about deconstruction.
Yeah.
In order to get the selfhood, you're going to have to avoid being overwhelmed by the tribe.
Hmm.
Because he's talking about the collectivist factors in this world. You know, collectivist factors meaning other people, their
yeah.
ways, the whole consensus is there to erase your sense of self.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's an idea that, you know, I've heard that previously, and it's very interesting, and it feels very true, you know, that, you know, just as you say, the soul, and including, you know, your goals and your ambitions in that sense, your true goals and ambitions are something that you earn and that you discover on the way as you, you know, get in contact, I guess, with your soul, or do we even, you know, create it, as you say, I mean...
Well, see, we have to be, because what would be the purpose of our life then? If the thing was already given to us in a full way, a complete way, then what is the mean? It would just render everything meaningless.
Yeah, yeah.
There must be some purpose to, you know, people always say, is there a purpose to everything I'm doing? You bet there's a purpose. It doesn't got to do with finding God and sitting at the right hand of Jesus. The purpose of all your life, the purpose, is to develop yourself.
Yeah.
You are the clay that's being made into the, you know, the David. You are the one who's being made into the Christ. This is the teachings of all metaphysical teachers.
Yeah.
Now, in the Gospel of Thomas, one of the most profound statements that I know anywhere is in the Manichaean Gospel of Thomas, this so-called uncanonical book that was, you know, left out of the Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
And it says, "When you know yourselves, then you will be known. And you will know that you are the sons of the living Father." He's talking about the self. The living
yeah.
Father is the living self.
Hmm.
"But if you do not know yourselves, then you are in poverty, and you are poverty."
Hmm.
So it's the same refrain that at Delphi they said, "Know thyself."
Yeah.
In Vedanta they say self-realization is necessary before God-realization, okay?
Hmm.
So here is what and these were the words of Christ. These were the uncanonical, apocryphal words of Christ that they had to leave out of the Bible, because... this was important that people did not take responsibility to
yeah.
know themselves.
Yeah.
Well, Henrik, you are living in a world filled with people who have no clue about themselves, who are operating from the, you know, the sphere of the ego.
Yeah. And this
that
is...
means that these people, from a spiritual religious point of view, are ghosts walking around. They're people who don't even register their voice, their meaning, their life, has no registration.
Yeah. And this is programmable also, I guess. You know, artificial needs and stuff like this.
Now, you're talking about the connections between the physical and the psychic world.
Mm.
Because now that we have this interior life, how does it operate? The interior life is the essence of division. Now you have things that happen outside you in the world, and you have this whole other, you know, hemisphere, this whole other world within your head that you know, we consider normal.
Yeah.
And then Jung said something incredible. He said, if things go wrong in the world, this is because something is wrong in the individual, because something is wrong in me. Therefore, if I am sensible, I shall put myself right first. For this I need, because no outside authority no longer means anything to me. I need a knowledge of the innermost foundations of my own being, in order that I may base myself firmly on the eternal facts of the human psyche. So here's a man looking at the chaos of the world and saying that it's what I've been saying in my work as well, that all the tyranny, all the cruelty and justice that you see in the world, and all the problems are caused by the disarrangement within the psyche of the person.
Mm.
But you see, we have been brought up in schools that don't even introduce you to yourself.
Yeah.
In fact, their whole job is to get you away from yourself. And they do not explore this incredible connection between psychic and physical energy.
Yeah.
You know, B.F. Skinner and J.B. Watson, you know, the behaviorists, behaviorism was, in vogue for such a, decade after decade. This was taught in Stanford University, from the top universities of the world.
Yeah.
They had these so-called experts who said that there wasn't even a thing called consciousness.
Amazing.
Here we are talking about connections between consciousness and the world. J.B. Watson literally said that because consciousness was not physically observable, it didn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
My God, Henrik. That puts a China cup above you.
Yeah.
As a human being. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Puts the sewage in the drains above you, because it's physical, it's observable, it must exist. But consciousness, the things that created Rembrandt and Bruegel, the things that created Handel's Messiah and Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, that doesn't exist. That can't be seen.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an illusion.
Mentioned. Yeah.
This was taught, my friend, from the highest universities.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it's. I mean, in some sense, it's. I guess we are also returning to the science of the soul, or at least on the outsides of science. Finally, we're going into that again. So that's a
possibility. That's right. And luckily, their theories were so vagrant and so utterly unsustainable that, they had their fling, and then, of course, they had to get rid of it because the thing was just so a laugh. But they tried it. I mean, this, people were failed.
Yeah.
People couldn't get PhDs and degrees because they wouldn't buy into this.
Yeah.
This was the big hegemony for years. People may think, laugh at it now. This was the in thing, this positivism and atomism and behaviorism.
Mm.
Most of America is brought up on it.
Yeah. Amazing. So can we go into, the way that in authentic lives, life give rise to the evil men in power, on the highest level, I guess, there.
How it works with the people at the top?
Yeah. I mean, is this also, our psychic, the thing we're talking about here, is it this that gives rise to evil men in power?
Yeah. The ego, by being so completely infirm, has I was talking in the one of the web streams, the Future of Mankind, about identification complex.
Yeah.
You see, look, when a child is very young, right? When you have a young child that's in a family, that child inevitably recognizes the father as a supreme power. Let's just assume that the father is the dominant one in the family.
Mm.
Usually, it's not, but just for argument's sake, let's just say that the father is the one who looks strong, the one who goes out to work, the one who kicks the ass of anybody that's bothering the child.
Yeah.
So if the father looks like the strong one, the child will obviously identify with that power, because the child is identifying because it knows that it's weak. It knows that it is impotent.
Mm.
It feels lesser. It's brought up to feel that way.
Mm.
And therefore, it will identify with this, strong figure.
Sure.
As the prime object.
Yeah.
Now, and you will listen and you will believe, that the child will believe what the father says. He will give it allegiance. He will accept it This is not, the father's not demanding to any, you know, too much. The child will just basically, of its own nature, you know, set this father figure up as an authority figure.
Mm.
We do the same thing with God. You know, the God we don't even see.
Mm.
God is, remember saying ideas in the mind?
Mm, yeah.
Well, God is an idea in the mind, and we do that. We say God is in his heaven, you know, he's an authority. So, when the ego realizes its own sort of relative impotency, it inevitably identifies with those who are strong. It already does this as a child, and then later on people grow up and they're still children. You know, I mean, you can grow up to be 30, but you can be emotionally, you know, like a teenager or younger.
Mm.
We know this anyway. I mean, it's obvious. You know, there's people,
yeah,
there's physical instances where there's people who are 30 or 40, you know, they have an IQ of a teenager, right?
Yeah, sure.
You accept that when it's physical or mental. Well, believe me, it's the same thing emotionally.
Hmm.
So this is how these individuals, you know, use this by keeping us at a very emotionally, you know, arrested,
yeah,
level.
Yeah.
And you know, this is goes for the Bible. You know, you read Peter 2.
Mm.
In the book of Peter, it says, "Slaves, submit yourself to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if a man bears up under pain of unjust suffering, because he is conscious of God. But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God." So Peter is happy to tell you, don't rebel. You take any kind of suffering from a leader or an evil tyrant.
Yeah.
Because God thinks that's good. He doesn't want you to rebel and kill that tyrant and throw him into the ocean. No, no, no. You're meant to suffer until your life is not worth living. But that's okay in God's eyes. And everybody believed it. You know, Eric Fromm, he says in his book, Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, the sick individual finds himself at home with other similarly sick individuals. The whole culture is geared towards this kind of pathology.
Yeah.
The result is that the average individual does not experience the separateness and the isolation that the fully schizophrenic person feels. He feels at ease amongst those who suffer the same deformation. In fact, it is the fully sane person who feels isolated in the insane society.
Yeah.
Now, that's the outsider. The outsider has an insanity of his own, because he doesn't fit in with the consensus, you see?
Yeah, yeah.
Of all those people who've bought into this. And here's one of the greatest quotes about this, the evil man, is from Glenn Parton. He wrote a book called The Machine in Our Heads.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "We have internalized our masters, which is a well-known psychological response to trauma." See, again,
yeah,
the ego is born out of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing it does is it finds some handrails to lean on. When faced with an overwhelming terror, the human mind splits, and part of itself models itself after the oppressor. This is an act of appeasement. So it's what we call identifying with the object of one's hate. Subliminally, of course, you hate the master, but, you know, we have this trauma, this ego-based trauma.
Mm.
That is basically, in short, how it would, you know, identify with these leaders who pretend and put on the image of being powerful and also knowing and all the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And this is the, you know, the big daddy that you've been talking about earlier, I guess.
And it's very hard to seduce people out of this. My work, you know, is basically to get people back to the magic as opposed to the sorcery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The people that are in power, Henrik, are sorcerers. And sorcery is defined as anything that gets in the way of magic.
Hmm.
Magic is organic, it's natural. You know, let's go back to Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Sauron and his henchmen, Saruman, the wizard, they are, for people who are familiar with the book, they are the sorcerers.
Yeah.
Whereas Gandalf and Radagast, you see, and the elven kings, Elrond and people like this, they are the magicians.
Yeah.
They bring forth magic because they have a totally different way of dealing with you. They're not dealing with you as an ego. Just like an animal, no animal deals with you as an ego. Animals always relate to us as a self, which is why people say they like to be around animals.
Yeah.
But the sorcerer, he wants to block that magic from flowing. And we now have such people in power all over the world. And the one reason why, one of the reasons why we promote these people is, remember last week or the last time we were talking about the branches of guilt, and that one of them is we defend the lie that we're living?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Denial connects to denial and defend. Well, listen, what do these guys do? These politicians do that for the whole race.
Yeah.
You're doing it in your own head, and then they go and go, we're going to defend the whole way of life. America's corporate, super-destructive, tyrannous, narcissistic world. Gee, this is the greatest thing. We've got to defend it from those mad Easterners, those turban-wearing freaks.
Yeah.
We're going to come in and take it all away. And every culture, you know, the Muslims are believing, don't come in and take away our little story.
Yeah, yeah.
See, so we have defense now, and the stronger the person is that says we're going to come in and defend all this rubbish that you own, this is what we also then vote for. You know, I said in one of the DVDs that there's a very important word for people to remember, and it's the word iatrogenic. I-A-T-R-O-G-A-N-I-C. Iatrogenic, or iatrogenic. And they can look it up in a dictionary, and it means the sickness and disease that is caused by doctors or members of any kind of, you know, establishment or institution.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And it's pretty much willful. Like, for instance, when a doctor does some malpractice, that's an iatrogenic act.
Yeah, yeah.
We have politicians, we have media who are operating on this iatrogenic, strategy.
Yeah.
In which they literally disseminate poisons and diseases, and they're dealing with us subliminally in order to keep us in this super arrested state. And then we do the rest. In our sickness, as we think we are going to fall and lose our balance, we, you know, rely on the braces that they offer us. This is connected to, you know, rising crime. I mean, when you feel yourself so socially impotent, one of the other ways is acting out. See, there's a dark side of this as well, Henrik, that's becoming more and more apparent, is that the impotent person who feels that he's just got no power in this world, that every, you know, his whole sense of self has been taken away, and he's got Big Brother over his head, and everyone else seems so powerful, there's another reaction to that, which means that you can act out. And that means, you know, the psychopathic reaction, in which people go out and commit crimes and do murders, in order to feel a kind of empowerment. Yeah, and then we turn around and blame them and lock them up. Okay, I guess, you know, that's never going to change.
Yeah.
But is anyone looking at the reason as to why a human being who's, you know, has a really even a good side in many ways would want to go out and do these heinous acts and then, you know, end up in an 8.5-foot cell for the rest of their lives? You know, why do people do that?
Yeah.
So this psychology, this feeling that people don't want to give their power away, then they say, but I must feel powerful. Society denies me doing it. Okay, let me go around and murder somebody, or murder people and break windows and, you know, be in gangs. Because human beings are being denied a true sense of empowerment, so they're going to find it in these, you know, illegitimate ways.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and also, of course, we can say, you know, because time and time again, a lot of, you know, stuff like corruption and this is being exposed, and we can see time and time again, you know, how our leaders and businessmen at the top, you know, constantly are, you know, using their positions to gain, you know, their personal wealth or whatever. But many times people again and again return to the idea that, you know, we need a strong leader and we need to, you know, follow this guy or that guy or whatever.
Yeah.
So that might also connect with this then. So
it is. It absolutely does.
Yeah.
The human being who's looking for self, he doesn't require any of that. He may admire true strength. He may admire sporting prowess. Somebody who's, you know, athletic or whatever, you can admire it, but you don't then you give your whole self to it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like Ayn Rand saying she doesn't believe in altruism, which also I do not believe. That, she said, that doesn't mean that you don't help others.
Yeah, exactly.
If you see somebody in desperate need, you must help.
Yeah.
But you don't lay your life down to help those people. You don't lose something infinitely precious, you know, that, you know, you don't try to lose your life to help another person cross the road.
Yeah.
That's altruism. So we have to have things in balance. You can admire strength. You can cultivate strength. You can be strong. My message is not a message of meekness and weakness.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, there are a lot of ways we can go here. We just have about, you know, 5 minutes left here before the hour is up. But is there something specific you'd like to dive into these last few minutes here, Michael?
Well, just that there's a lot of... when we're talking basically about, you know, the outsider, that is the key thing that he has to remember is that the outsider is a person who I believe has a what I would call a moral superiority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from my blog and from so many interactions that I have with people, I see this outsider streak in them. And what I realize is that a lot of their suffering like we talked last time, is coming from their empathy, natural empathy to those who are in a terrible, you know, dumbed down state.
Yeah.
But what's the good of the outsider killing himself with this empathy so he can't move? He can't create because he's just so empathic with other people suffering that he renders himself, you know, it's another kind of impotency.
Mm.
So what the message I try to get across to people who are, fighting with these different kinds of concepts and trying to understand this is that, look, have your empathy, see it for what it is, but don't get, you know, too strung out over that. You
mm-hmm.
have to realize what is going on in your life. It's the Hamlet complex.
Yeah.
You are a morally and spiritually superior person. People don't like to use that word superior anymore, except when there's a material, you know, value in it. If you're a kid at 5 years of age is drawing beautiful, fantastic pictures, you'll soon accept that that child, or if he's playing piano wonderfully, or if he's a chess prodigy, we immediately accept, you know, because now media fame will be involved and money will be involved. Now the kid's a genius. He's intellectually superior. Then nobody has a problem accepting it, right?
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, we know this. You know, how come then that human beings, when you talk about moral superiority or spiritual superiority, go, oh, but you can't talk about that. Everybody's meant to be equal.
Exactly.
So we have this other voice that's coming in that's very, very pernicious. And in the road to tomorrow, the road to the future, the outsider, my message to the outsider is realize, don't be proud of it. Don't, you know, get into ego over it. But realize that you are a morally superior person.
Mm.
And this is going to cause you an enormous pain. But look at the bright side of it. If you can see the problems that are happening in the world, it means that you're turned on. You can see it. You're not part of that problem.
Yeah.
And when you realize that there is a moral aristocracy, and that just like Hamlet, if you are hanging around people that are deeply vampiristic and deeply immoral and deeply corrupt and totally sensationalistic and narcissistic, you will suffer. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
You know, the great masters have said, if you're out of touch with your higher wisdom body and out of touch with your spirit, you will actually suffer. So there is two kinds of suffering. There's the suffering of the person who's dumbed down and lost and the victim of his ego.
Mm.
And the outsider has his particular kind of suffering too. But the difference is, the outsider is a philosopher king. He's like Plato's philosopher king. He's an elite. He's a person who is, you know, marked by the higher force.
Yeah.
And definitely has a purpose in this life, has a dharma in this life.
And he's a man who has, I guess, also then has, you know, kind of created his soul or earned his soul.
Precisely. And he will know that he's earned it.
Yeah.
He hasn't allowed the government or, you know, the school system or jumped through a bunch of hoops to think he knows a lot of stuff. This is a person who has made his own life. He's actually carved his own statue.
Yeah.
He's come alive of his own hands and formed his own soul, and he knows himself. Yes, there is bitter tears along that Siddhartha road, but there's also the greatest joys as well.
Do you, Michael, at all tie reincarnation into this? Is this a recurring thing that we can work on through lifetimes? Do you think
I try not to get into too much of the metaphysics.
Yeah.
I do have tremendous ideas about these, but in my public work, I try to avoid too much abstractia because we have a culture of escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, we talked about escapism as being one of the branches of the tree of the guilt complex.
Sure, yeah.
So, you know, yeah, I got some fantastic ideas. I have some very radical ideas about reincarnation. I don't totally buy into it as the way the world is, but, you know, I mean, it is a fascinating concept. It does. It should be studied and thought about.
Mm-hmm.
It may have tremendous significance. The way I look at it is that there is no such thing as a future or a past. You know, my philosophy is that people are living as ghosts or aliens.
Mm.
When you live in the past and you give the past all your energy, then you're living like a ghost.
Yeah.
If you're a future person and everything about your life is about the future, then you're like living like some alien, some sort of sci-fi creature that just lives in this, you know, super progressive world, which also doesn't exist. So the man of truth, the man who's finding himself, is a natural human being who must live in the now.
Yeah.
And in the now is the birth of tomorrow. All tomorrows are seated in what people do now. I keep getting these, you know, comments from people where they're saying, what about tomorrow? What about tomorrow?
Yeah.
What about tomorrow? Forget tomorrow. It's all linked in this moment now. This is when you're incarnating, right this minute.
Yeah.
And, you know, the message is try to keep your mind and your consciousness and your senses as fresh and as clean and as spontaneous and as mutable as possible, because if you're constantly demanding stimuli and experience to be fresh and new, then you're going to be very sadly disappointed by the time you reach 30.
Hmm.
The man who's ever young is dying. dying all the time. He's renewing and resurrecting his mind every day. The mind is what needs to be kept fresh and new, not experience.
Very interesting. Michael, we are totally out of time, but in the last minute or so, tell everyone about, you know, your excellent DVD series and how they can get it, and also, of course, again, about your website.
Okay, we have a navigation website that helps you to get to all the sites that I have, because I got about 7 websites. So if you go to michaeltessarian.com, just my name, michaeltessarian.com, you'll be able to access from that site all the other ones. The DVDs are available on their own website, which is originsandoracles.com. But, you know, there's tons of free web stream out there. I have a blog, which people can get to through michaeltessarian.com. And on the blog, you'll see the calendar and also what's new. And if you go to What's New, then you'll see all the different interviews and web streams, all the free material that we have, you know, for people to get a total fix on what we're saying. So, because these are subjects that are very large, very interesting, but, you know, it takes time to really digest them properly.
Does. Yeah, yeah.
A lot of my work approaches these subjects in a kind of a different way, so I cross over a lot of different subject matter.
Absolutely.
And that can be kind of new for people. So, you know, go and watch the videos, go and listen to the interviews, and get a grip on this and use that, and then, you know, check out the DVDs.
Yeah, originsandoracles.com is an excellent DVD series, and it's totally amazing. You got to get yourself a DVD from that. And again, Michael, let's continue this next month. There were a few things we didn't get to here today, but let's continue on this theme, and again, I'm looking forward very much to next month.
Right, and then we have some interviews on the subscriber area of Red Ice, right?
Absolutely, yeah, sure. We got a new we put it up, I guess, last Sunday, I think, on technology and transhumanism and a lot more, and hopefully we can do a few more of those also. So, again, I'm looking forward to that very much.
Yeah, those are great projects. Thank you. We'll do it again.
We'll do. Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Where are we going? We are going to continue our talk with Michael now in the subscriber section. We are going to begin to talk about Theosophy and Helena Blavatsky, and we'll also get into talking about the hijacking of cults, organizations, and secret and not-so-secret societies. Very interesting stuff with Michael Sorian for our subscribers. If you're not a subscriber, do consider signing up with us. You'll get full access to our growing archive, and at the same time, you'll help and support the radio show and the website so we can keep going. Thank you all for listening to the show, and thanks for your emails and comments. We try to answer as much of it as we can. Also, thanks to Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls. We will be back this Sunday with a new show for you. This is Henrik Palmgren. Take care.
And where are we going?
Welcome.
Welcome.
This is Red Eye.